Ben jij klaar voor het allerleukste 30PLUS single-event van deze zomer? Samen met Indebuurt.nl en Theater Unisof in Wageningen organiseer ik, Casper van Koten, het Swipe Festival 2024. Met comedy, muziek, wetenschap en coaching. Swipe Festival. Maar vooral heel veel leuke mensen. Bestel nu je kaart op swipefestival.nl. Swipe, swipe.
Hallo, fijn dat je luistert naar Stuurloos, waarin we het hebben over hoe wij Nederlanders een beter bestuur kunnen krijgen. Mijn naam is Koestaaf Bessems en in deze podcast van de Volkskrant ga ik raden bij mensen die daarover ons denken verder kunnen helpen. Deze keer Rosie Cullington, die een boek schreef over de consultancy-industrie en hoe die bedrijven verzwakt, overheden infantiliseert en de economie uit het lood trekt. The Big Con heet het boek in het Engels. Steviger dan de Nederlandse vertaling die net uit is en simpelweg de consultancy-industrie heet. Want con, dat klinkt echt naar zwendel. En als je het boek leest, dan denk je ook wel, waar is deze branche van meer dan 800 miljard euro eigenlijk op gebaseerd? Hoe kan het dat kerntaken van de overheid aan consultants worden overgelaten? En kan die overheid zich nog uit deze ongezonde relatie losmaken? Daar ga ik het over hebben met auteur Rosie Cullington, verbonden aan het Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose in Londen. En dat wordt geleid door de bekende econoom Mariana Mazzucato, met wie ze het boek schreef. Het gesprek is in het Engels. Als dat te lastig is, er verschijnt een korte geschreven versie. En nou ja, de planning kan altijd wijzigen, maar die zou vanaf 3 juni te vinden moeten zijn bij de Volkskrant. As I was talking to people just around me about the topic of your book and the conversation that we're going to have, the consulting industry, I noticed that still quite a lot of people think of that as, you know, just companies coming in to give some advice to other companies and to governments. How accurate is that?
On the one hand, so what we find is, or what we have found is that businesses and governments contract consultancies for various different reasons, right? So sometimes it might be because there is a genuine demand for some expertise, some advice that government doesn't have internally. Very often they are contracted to essentially do the functions of government. What we have found during the research for the book is that businesses and governments and other organizations contract consultancies for various different reasons. So there isn't one reason why consultancies might get contracted. The kind of standard view, the view that comes from the industry and from some schools of thought in economics, is that consultancies are contracted because they are able to provide this kind of objective source of knowledge, this expertise that can't be found anywhere else in the economy. Sometimes perhaps a more generalist or kind of business process form of expertise. And that in providing this expertise to clients, they are helping those clients to create cost savings. They're helping them to become more efficient. And therefore, they are creating what are called economies of scale in knowledge. So this is the kind of mainstream or dominant view. I don't think we can call it mainstream because I don't think, you know, most people think about the consulting industry very much at all and its role in the economy.
No, that's true. But as far as they have an image of it, this is sort of the classical image.
You know, I would say this has been the dominant kind of view from some strands of economics. Of course, when we speak to people who work in the public sector and many people who work as consultants themselves, they will have a very different view of the role of the consulting sector and of what consultants actually do. Consultants, they'll tend not to reflect that they are, you know, creating value by reducing transaction costs or that they're genuinely transferring expertise or providing advice. They very much recognize often that they can be brought in to do things like legitimate a decision that has already been made in the company, doing this thing called what people who we spoke to in interviews have described as rubber stamping. They know that a decision has already been made and they go in to, you know, give it what was described in our book by one person we spoke to as the Deloitte stamp of approval.
Right. So leadership in an organization has really already made up its mind about what to do, But they want to be able to tell the organization or superiors, whoever, or the public, well, this is something that was really necessary to do because Deloitte or some other consultancy company has really done some research and come up with a report, and this is what they're telling us to do.
Exactly. So that's one reason. And as I mentioned, there's a few other reasons.
But you describe also that they actually do the governing in many instances instead of government.
Yes. So particularly since the 1990s in Anglo-Saxon economies and slightly later in other economies, and this certainly isn't to the same extent everywhere, but in many countries, governments have increased outsourcing of both public services development and implementation delivery, right? And that could be both to what are, you know, considered public service companies, public services consultancies or outsourcing consultancies. So in the UK, that would be, for example, Serco. I don't know any Dutch equivalents. In Denmark, it would be Falck, you know, these kind of big companies. Perhaps you have Serco, Sodexo, Atos also in the Netherlands. But what these companies actually do often is manage the contracting process on behalf of the government. So they're, most of what they do is not actually delivering contracts themselves. It is subcontracting on behalf of government. You know, the kind of growth of these types of contracts, which are called prime contracts, really grew, as I mentioned, from around the 1990s under this idea that sought to challenge neoliberalism, that came with this theory that the role of government was very important in setting an agenda and determining what was valuable for society, but as much as possible, government should still get out of the way when it comes to delivering things. And if it could be more efficient to turn to the private sector to do things, then more government should do that. So the growth of consulting contracts, both for these kind of outsourcing services, but also policy advice, other types of kind of implementation or evaluation, these kind of core tasks of an administration. We've seen an increase in all of these types of contracts since that period.
And can you describe a few examples of activities that these companies engage in that people might be surprised to hear about? I think you mentioned the vaccine rollout in the UK, for instance.
Yeah, so in the UK, and not just in the UK, in many other countries, but the UK, it has been particularly widespread. The UK government turned to big management consultancies, so the big three and the big four, which are the companies that we focus on in the book. So that's the big three are McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, and Bain & Company. And they are companies that are usually associated with being these kind of strategy consultancies. And they also have the big four accountancies that actually, you know, get more of their revenue from contracts for management consulting services and for auditing services, and the profit margins on consulting are much bigger as well. And the big four are Ernst & Young, KPMG, PwC, and Deloitte. So during the pandemic, the UK government contracted, in particular Deloitte, but also the other companies as well, to provide a range of services and do a number of things as part of the pandemic response, including in the UK, the development of our national test and trace system. So, you know, the kind of both the virus monitoring, but also the digital app that was procured by the government, which was, you know, deemed by the Public Accounts Committee, which is a parliamentary body that evaluates and monitors public spending. This body found that the test and trace program had, you know, completely failed on its own terms, or pretty much had failed to reduce chains of transmission. So that's one of the things. Deloitte was also contracted for helping to help source personal protective equipment for the NHS, so the kind of clothing that was going to keep NHS staff safe. It was also contracted to evaluate the NHS's medical ethics review program for research done in the NHS. So you think on all of these things, you know, the question becomes, if the government needed help, why did it turn to Deloitte? Why was Deloitte viewed as having expertise in procuring personal protective equipment, something that the NHS has done since its inception? Why was it contracted to work on medical ethics? You know, isn't this something that we have professors and patient groups who probably should have been at the heart of that process? So again, you know, what we criticize is not necessarily the involvement of advisors or consultants, understood as a kind of much broader term than we have, than we generally kind of understand the term, but actually the scale and scope of the involvement of consultants.
Yeah, this is a very big issue here in the Netherlands as well. Recently, numbers came out that this year, again, a record number has been spent on outsourcing. Officially, the goal is to reduce it. Parliament has adopted a motion also to reduce it, but every year it's more and more. The question that you ask, like why ask Deloitte or these other consulting firms, what is your answer to that? Why are governments so, why is it almost a reflex to get these companies in?
Yeah, so there's two levels to this. So the big con describes not just the ways that the consulting sector itself, the things that consultancies do to try to convince clients or potential clients of its value. And we do look at those things in the book. You know, we have a whole chapter on what we call consultology, the ways that, that the kind of mechanisms that consultancies employ to try to prove that they are neutral brokers of expertise, that they are legitimate, all of these things. But we also have to look again at this relationship, the historical relationship between governments, businesses, and consultancies, and the broader transformations of capitalism and of government and the way we think about government in our economies. So the reason why the book is structured as it is, the reason why we begin the analysis with these two history chapters, is because, you know, we don't think that you can understand the big con without understanding the ways that government has been, but civil servants and the public have lost faith in civil servants and people who work in the public sector. People who work in the public sector have lost confidence in themselves. And the ways that these narratives, you know, really were turbocharged from the 1980s in places like the UK and the US. It's no coincidence that under Margaret Thatcher in the UK, this is when we really saw a kind of very rapid growth of spending on management consultancies. So consulting spend at the beginning of Thatcher's tenure in 1979 was just £6 million per year. And by the end of her tenure, 11 years later, it was £246 million. So it really is, you know, this kind of this huge growth. And they were brought in to provide advice on things like how to provide the railways, how to make services more efficient. So it really, you know, was the kind of growth of consulting was really, really went hand in hand with the growth of an idea that government was an ineffective actor in the economy and it should just get out of the way as much as possible.
Yeah, you mentioned these two periods, right? You already said a moment ago. One movement being neoliberalism, if you will, Reagan, Thatcher, bluntly stating that government only stands in the way of all the good that markets can do for society and really should be diminished as much as possible. But then right after that came the third way, as it is called. We had a government like that here in Holland as well, led by Wim Kok, who was prime minister back then. No idea if you're aware of this, but he was actually credited by Bill Clinton as being the first one with the third way.
Yeah.
And remember, everyone here in Holland was like, oh, the American president is giving our prime minister a compliment. And everyone was very proud.
Yeah.
But now we look back on that period, I think, a little bit differently because their philosophy was, okay, no, government is not totally useless, but it is more a facilitator of the market, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this was, I think, we, you know, it's great, I guess, that there is a conversation around the third way in the Netherlands. But in the UK, that isn't the case. In the US, that isn't really the case. You know, there are kind of two perspectives. One is that Tony Blair and Clinton were true progressives who, you know, really brought back social services and brought kind of the people back into the economy. The other, which we see kind of more from the left, is that Blair and Clinton were a continuation of Thatcher and Reagan. Now, on the one hand, they were a continuation of Thatcher and Reagan insofar as, you know, as we saw in the UK, as we've discussed, outsourcing actually increased and became entrenched under the Blair government and also under Clinton. But on the other hand, it's important to distinguish, I think, also for the politics of today, where we're seeing a kind of return of the state, a recognition that government has an important role to play again in kind of shaping our economies and meeting the challenge of the green transition. The differences are still very important because actually, as you mentioned, we talk in the book about this this phrase that really epitomizes the third way, which was that the role of government should be to steer but not row. which, you know, which we argue kind of is a logical fallacy, is illogical, because we suggest that actually governments cannot steer if they are not doing some rowing. If they don't know which way to go because they haven't been rowing, if they've lost, you know, the muscles from rowing, then they're not going to be able to kind of steer in the right direction, or the direction that people kind of want them to.
Because you need the experience from doing to learn about how to do it.
Exactly, yes.
This podcast or this series of interviews is a quest, so to say. Like the main question hanging over it is how do the Netherlands get a better government? And one of the big topics that has come up a lot is the broken connection between, on the one hand, policymakers, the people who think out the policy, and then on the other hand, people actually executing it on the ground. And that seems to relate also to what you are saying now. Like, if you outsource a lot of your core activities, then you lose a lot of knowledge also.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not just the case that outsourcing can be inefficient, and it can be very inefficient. It can cost a lot more money than could be saved, or it could cost a lot more money than it would if things were done internally, right? We might point to various things that happened during the pandemic as an example of that. But it's not just that it can become inefficient in the short term, you know, cost inefficient. It's also that when we take a kind of longer term horizon, the cost of not trying to develop these capabilities in house, or trying to or investing internally within the public sector, can also be that the government loses the ability to adapt. It becomes, you know, this is where this word infantilizes comes from. The government stops developing, it stops learning, it stops being able to use knowledge that is developed internally to kind of create additional capacity. And when we think about what governments are for, you know, often we don't think about governments as being particular, or government, public sectors, government ministries, government departments and agencies, teams within them. We don't think about these as being, you know, particularly specialist, because the dominant idea about governments is that, you know, they're full of people who push paper and they're boring bureaucrats, and what they do is mundane, which is, you know, it's just plainly untrue. If you spend even a day in government, if you spend a career in government, everyone who works in government knows that actually what goes on requires this specialist knowledge, requires this quite tacit knowledge, this experience that can't necessarily be codified.
Well, but arguably, because of outsourcing, it has become more true. Like, I think you're right when you say that working in government requires all this specialist knowledge. But a big issue seems to be that less and less specialist knowledge is available in government because, well, we had one other guest in this series. He has a very technical software background, and he took issue with this a lot. And he sort of described it as, you know, government departments, ministries, they've become a bunch of contracts. Like this, they still have two main activities. One is a very judicial side where they contract others to do stuff. And the other important thing that they do is communication about what they're doing. But the actual work and the expertise that comes with it seems to have leaked away.
I mean, completely, absolutely. We talk about it in the book as being a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So the more that government outsources, the more that it becomes dependent on these other actors. It creates, you know, a relationship of dependency between the government and between the consulting sector. And that is, you know, part of the issue with the consulting industry and the business models that kind of constitute the consulting industry, is that actually it can be very profitable and very lucrative. It can be important for the growth of this sector that government and other organizations come to depend on them as a source of capacity. And certainly we have seen that. But, you know, if we think about in democratic societies, what government is supposed to do, what we want government to be able to do, which is to be able to adapt as our needs and demands as citizens change, as new challenges emerge, such as with the climate crisis, as businesses, you know, create new things, as we're seeing in big tech. We want governments to be able to adapt, to regulate them, to shape those industries, and to be able to, you know, continue to provide the things that we need. If government isn't investing in house, then it's not able to adapt in this way.
Sometimes it might go a little bit fast for people, but you mentioned there also, business-wise, it's not in the interest of the consulting industry to make their clients independent of the consulting industry. So there's a very strange, perverted incentive there, almost. Because, of course, ideally, that is what would happen. Like, you're wondering how to do something, you get consultants in, and they know from the industry or experiences with other clients or whatever how to do it, and then you learn how to do something, and you're off. But that's often not the mechanism, you say.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, we describe, we use the metaphor of, if you imagine a bad therapist is one that keeps their client in therapy forever, rather than, you know, providing them with the tools that they need to be able to manage their mental health and develop and all the rest of it, or to be able to get better. So that's one way that we can look at it. I mean, the broader kind of implications of this as well are that, you know, when we think about, as I've already mentioned before, when we think about the people who make up this sector, we know that many consultants are brilliant and well-intentioned. They are often young people who want to have an impact in the world, who want to be at the forefront of the green transition, for example. But this business model can be very stifling to those values-oriented ambitions that people working in consultancy often have, because there is an imperative to ensure that, you know, and this imperative might not always win over, but we have to suggest it has a tendency to win over, because the sector, you know, invariably in individual companies have a profit bottom line. They might say they have a triple bottom line, but they are looking to grow. You know, they are looking to maintain profits and maintain profitability and to grow ultimately. So they have a bottom line, and that can stifle the type of advice, or can influence the type of advice that consultants are kind of, individual consultants might want to give. So a group of individual consultants might come to a conclusion that a company should do one thing if it wants to reduce its emissions. And if that thing, even if it is the most effective thing to reduce carbon emissions, is going to be the most expensive thing or more expensive, it might suggest this other thing, because ultimately that's what the client might, you know, prefer to hear from them, and therefore be more likely to contract that company again in the future.
Yeah, because it's always very much aimed to cutting costs, becoming leaner, therefore pleasing stockholders, basically.
Yeah, often, or like, you know, if we look at this kind of growth of climate and sustainability consulting, for example, that might be a way of, okay, how do we reduce emissions but do so in the cheapest way? So it might not have increasing profits, but it might, as the kind of primary goal, but it might have, you know, getting this other goal done in the cheapest way possible.
And there are quite blatant conflicts of interest. And in the book, you use actually climate consulting, I guess, as the main example of that, where on the one hand, one client might be a government wanting to fight climate change or wanting to initiate climate adaptation. And the other hand, big fossil fuel companies might be your other clients with completely different interests.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talk about conflicting interests quite a lot in the book, and the climate consulting sector, the climate consulting boom, as we describe it, is probably one of the most obvious examples of this. So we use the case of McKinsey's work that it did with the Australian government. So McKinsey was paid $6 million Australian dollars to do the analysis and the modelling underpinning the Australian government's net zero strategy. Now, this strategy was found to be completely full of holes. When it was launched at COP26 in Glasgow in 2021, it was ranked 60th out of 60 net zero strategies, because it didn't even get Australia to net zero by 2050. It was like 80% to net zero, and then relying on kind of a bunch of technologies that didn't already exist yet. When, you know, commentators in Australia started looking more at this, you know, they were asking, well, hang on a second, could the reason why McKinsey has produced this work that seemingly doesn't actually help our government get to net zero, could that be because it is trying to protect interests of its other firms, potentially? And they found, you know, McKinsey has advised 43 of the 100 biggest polluters. And, you know, they're not just looking at McKinsey, they're also asking, could the reason why the government recruited McKinsey in the first place, and we know the previous government in Australia was explicitly resistant to, you know, concerted government intervention in climate policy and climate governance. Could the reason why the government contracted McKinsey in the first place be that the government actually wasn't that interested in...
They knew it wouldn't be that ambitious. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
You almost have to admire it as a business as you go through your book, right? Because it almost seems like there are no circumstances in which the consultancy firms lose. Like, it doesn't matter what the developments are, what happens in society, be it Brexit, be it climate change, be it a financial crisis, doesn't really matter what happens. Under any circumstances, they seem to adapt and convince governments and other companies that they are who you need to call to fix things. And they do everything with almost no risk or responsibility, because when things go wrong, it is still the board of the actual company that hired them, or the minister who's responsible in parliament who gets all the slack for it.
Yeah, great point. I mean, in a way, you have to admire this, or you have to admire the success of this business model. It has been very successful, undoubtedly. It's now, at the time that we were trying to do estimates of the sector in 2021, it was somewhere between 700 to 900 billion. So almost $1 trillion globally, right? It's a big sector.
Almost hard to comprehend.
Yes, exactly. There is some kind of suggestion that it has shrunk a bit in the wake of the COVID-19 and, oil crisis induced global recession. But we see that after every kind of recession, actually. We see in the first couple of years a kind of shrinking of the size of the sector, but then it picks up speed again. So, they won't be worrying too much about shrinking at the moment. No, but I mean, absolutely right. And I guess that's also why we wanted to look at this in the way that we did. This is not just the case of a few people pulling some strings and whatever. Actually, they play a very important structural role in our economies today. They are providing advice to governments. They are doing things for governments. They are doing things for business. They're advising businesses. They are providing a source of legitimation and blame avoidance for businesses, while at the same time being able to avoid blame and actual risk taking themselves. It's a very profitable business model. That's why we also describe it as not just profitable, but it's a form of rent seeking, because the business model is such that the companies are able to take on and receive huge fees for these contracts without ever really taking on any of the risks of them themselves.
How did you personally get involved with the topic?
Yeah, so when I worked in public policy a couple of years ago, more than a couple of years ago now, when I first finished my undergraduate, before I came back to academia. In the UK, you don't need to do a master's before you can go into the real world of work, thankfully, because it's very expensive in the UK to do a master's. So I went and I worked in different public policy organizations for a few years. I also have two degrees in political science. So a lot of my friends went to work in consultancies straight after we graduated. I also, in one of my jobs, spent about 6 months working with a consultancy on secondment with one of the big four companies. And so got to kind of learn firsthand how they operate, and just became very interested in, the kind of scale and scope of the sector. While I was working in public policy, one of the things I was looking at as well was outsourcing in public health services. So that came across them kind of through my policy research. And then came to realize, even though increasingly, thank goodness, lots of journalists over the past few years have been doing fantastic investigative work looking at kind of cases where consultancies have been working with governments where they've maybe gone wrong, or working with business. There's a great book that was published at the end of last year as well called When McKinsey Comes to Town in the US. Like, investigative journalism has been really important in the past few years for shedding light on the fact that this sector exists, and that it is doing things that can be potentially harmful, or that it is involved in things that are potentially harmful. But at the time that we were writing this book, and still today, there wasn't a texts that try to situate the growth of this sector in these broader developments in government and capitalism. So we were kind of in, we use the cases and we're very grateful and we pay a lot of credit to the investigative journalism work. But what we were trying to do was really understand it kind of structurally and systemically and how it fits in with the economy.
And when you say we, that's Mariana Mazzucato and you?
Yes.
How did you end up writing it together?
Yeah, good question. It's actually something I get asked quite a lot, as you can imagine, because Mariana Mazzucato is amazing, global, superstar professor, economist. and I've long been a fan of her work, as you can imagine. I met Mariana in 2019 at a student conference. I was presenting some of my master's thesis research, and Mariana just happened to be the discussant on the panel for the where I was presenting my research. She was just volunteering for the day, you know, to speak to these young political economists. And I gave the presentation, and it was, you know, about outsourcing. Actually, it was about privatization that occurs through outsourcing of public sector digital infrastructures, which is research that I've published on since in academic journals. And after I gave the presentation, Mariana said, please apply to do a PhD with me. So that was amazing. I mean, wow, like her asking to do that. And then, you know, some months into my PhD, Mariana said, let's write this book together. I think someone needs to write a book about the role of the consulting industry. You know, I want to do more work on this. Let's do it together. And, you know, of course, at first I was pretty shocked. I was like, wow, you know, but we then worked together on it for a few years, and it was a great project. It was a great collaboration.
And so you were working already on outsourcing of IT services.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's also a very big issue here, for instance, especially with taxes. So there's real danger at the moment that our tax service in a few years will not be able to perform even its most basic tasks anymore, because all these systems are so old and not maintained. But also because the IT knowledge and experience is really not within those agencies anymore. So that's also a big topic here.
Yeah, a parallel case that, you know, perhaps you might want to look at, because it happened in Denmark. It sounds like a parallel case to what happened in the Danish tax authority a couple of years ago.
I read about it, yeah.
A lot of this came to a head with the crisis in the Danish tax authority, where basically it was found, I think it was 2016 or 2017, it was found that they were unable to implement some new legislation that the EU had introduced for members. And they were unable to implement it properly, and it was a huge crisis. And the Danish government subsequently did a report on the use, or how they go on to manage IT vendors and consultants and contractors in the future. And, you know, the language they use is very much that the knowledge that we need exists in the heads of a few vendors and contractors. We don't have it in the public sector, so we can't actually transform these technologies that are so fundamental to our, you know, to our tax system, and therefore to the Danish welfare state. You know, this is at the heart of it. And I did interviews with people who had been involved in this issue in the public sector as part of my research. And someone I spoke to from the Digitalization Agency, you know, the line that he said was, "We were at the point where it was the IT systems that mandated what the politicians could do and not the other way around."
We are in exactly that situation. So, like, they've just officially said, we can't do anything extra anymore for the next 4 years, more or less. The only thing we can do is try and repair enough to be able to do the basics. For instance, they wanted to lower taxes on fruit and vegetables, you know, for health reasons, couldn't do it, like too complicated. And this touches on something that I think for a lot of people still is counterintuitive. I think you mentioned it earlier in our conversation anymore, that outsourcing using consultants makes you less flexible, less agile. When, of course, the philosophy was, if you employ all those people yourselves and you have them on your payroll, then you're a slow giant, it's very hard to pivot. You're much more flexible when you're a lean organization and you only have the people who run all the processes and who organize, and then you just get the expertise in that you need whenever you need it. And then you're, you know, light on your feet and you move quick. But it seems like the exact opposite has come out of it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the issue, right? And this is where it comes back to this. While we have to really delve into assumptions about what knowledge is and how learning happens in the public sector, right? So the assumption of a kind of super lean organization, it may well work for example, a small programming organization where all of the knowledge is very clearly codifiable in a programming language. And perhaps then it is possible to switch in and out the programmers because everything is, you know, all of that knowledge is in code, as long as, of course, they're using the same programming language or whatever. That is not how knowledge exists and expertise exists in the real world. We can't codify most knowledge that exists, or not necessarily most knowledge. It very much depends, of course, on the type of work that someone's doing. But a lot of knowledge, particularly in the public sector, where so much of it, so much of kind of day-to-day knowledge about even how government works, you know, how the department works, how the team works, what the kind of service area is perhaps that a policy is working in, the if it's a public-facing frontline role, what the community is that that service is serving, all of this knowledge, you know, you can't just type it up on a piece of paper and hand it over to someone and expect that that's going to constitute knowledge transfer. So this idea of having a like super lean organization relies on an idea about knowledge that isn't real, that isn't how knowledge exists in the real world.
Well, and also it might work for some task in the short term.
Yes, yeah.
Like a limited task in the short term. But of course, the whole characteristic of government is that you have huge challenges for the next decades. That also seems to be, you know, maybe again, that's why climate change is such a good example. You would want a learning organization that is constantly working on this topic, getting better at it as they go along and withholding all the knowledge and expertise and experience within as you go along.
Absolutely. No, exactly. We know that the climate crisis is not going away anytime soon. So why would governments not be trying to build this capacity? You know, if we can't be certain about everything with the climate crisis. We can't know exactly when temperatures are going to become unlivable or when in Europe we might become affected by flash flooding or whatever. We can't be very accurate about some of these things, but we are certain that this is going to be a problem for a long, long time. So why are we not developing, you know, public sector capacity properly internally, in-house in the public sector to respond to the climate crisis? That's not to say that governments shouldn't also be working with people in particular areas outside of government, you know,
of course,
shouldn't be using this expertise. This isn't the case of governments doing everything by themselves, absolutely not. But it's recognizing that in order to be able to work well with other actors, government needs to have that knowledge itself internally as well.
Well, and you notice that other parties are often not engaged. For instance, academia or all sorts of other organizations and companies that have a lot of know-how.
Yes.
This I also remember, by the way, from the pandemic. There were a lot of companies, academics, people with field experience with pandemics elsewhere who were like, okay, I want to contribute to what's going on here. And they tried to get through to government, which was, of course, in crisis mode. So that is, you know, partly an excuse, but there also didn't seem to be any form for that. Like there was no real way to get in touch with your own government if you wanted to help out on something that you knew a lot about.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, when we talk at the end about in the climate crisis chapter, we talk about a professor who was one of the founders of the IPCC. Or helped to publish the first IPCC report. And if we look at the things that he was saying, Patrick Godwin Oluwabasi, if we look at the things that he was saying in the 1990s, and this was someone who had, you know, had this amazing research career as a meteorologist, both in Nigeria, but also globally in other parts of the world, was the leader of the World Meteorological Organization. The things that he was saying was, you know, this needs systemic change, this needs systemic change. He kept saying all of this. And it seems, you know, no one was listening to people like like him, you know, and there was a lot of pushback on this idea that there should be systemic intervention led by governments or even other actors in the climate crisis and kind of a green transition. And instead, it should be left up to markets to self-regulate and everything. We know now that, you know, market-led self-regulation approach to the climate crisis has not worked. It hasn't worked on its own term. That's not an opinion. That's a fact. You know, the IPCC supports that. And thankfully, many people now also recognize that government has an important role to play, as has been enshrined in the Paris Agreement and many other kind of climate laws that governments around the world are adopting. But, you know, you have to wonder why it is that, and not just kind of scientific expertise, not just people who are professors, but why that expertise and also the voices of people in, you know, communities that are most affected by the climate crisis, by groups that the voices of people who have different types of knowledge and experience when it comes to looking after the environment and ecosystems and biodiversity. So that would include, you know, indigenous communities, people who have different value systems when it comes to protecting the land. It also includes perhaps trade union groups, which I think probably need to have or certainly need to have a more central role in terms of thinking about how the green transition actually protects jobs and ensures that people have good livelihoods through it and aren't, you know, losing work or losing work when high emitting sectors invariably have to close down or reduce production. You know, all of these other voices could shape the type of green transition that we have. And instead, you know, advice is coming from one group. So we have to ask why that is.
Is there an escape from this? Because, as you said, it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, you mentioned a lot of your own friends went to work with consultancy companies. I'm curious if you've heard anything from them about the book, by the way. So maybe you can tell us about that as well. And you mentioned also people who have good intentions, who go to work there because they want to have an impact, be it on the green transition or anything else. It has become the place where a lot of talented people want to go and work, and government has become that place less so. If you just look at the allocation of funds, just where the money goes, well, you mentioned those figures yourselves, then so much money goes into that. How do you reverse this movement? Is that even possible?
Yeah, so the book is necessarily critical because we recognize that we need to analyze the sector properly. And part of doing the analysis is questioning the things that the sector says about its value that it's creating. But it's not a critical book insofar as we end on, you know, I think quite optimistic terms about how governments can rebuild capacity and can become, you know, effective democratic economic actors again. Part of that, you know, and these are the kind of first thing that we call for. It is a big challenge, but it is a necessary one, which is rethinking or transforming our narratives or the narratives that we have about the role of government in our economies, the role of learning in organizations in the public sector and across our other economies, of course, the involvement of democratic actors in the kind of advice that governments get. So that's one thing. But there are concrete things. We point to a number of concrete things that governments who have identified issues with their own capability and capacity or have identified that they have a dependency on consultancies or other contractors, things that they are doing to reduce their dependency and rebuild public sector capacity. So to give you an example, you know, the Danish government, Denmark's fascinating, right? Because in both public sector digitalization, but also in its use of consultancies, many people, because we view it as a kind of welfare state heaven. I'm in Denmark, but I'm not Danish. When we're coming from the outside, we often think, wow, Denmark must have everything right. But actually, the public sector in Denmark has fallen, you know, victim to many of the same flaws that the rest of our governments have, including when it comes to IT digitalization and when it comes to the use of consultants. And in 2019, the Danish government, when it was elected, came in pledging to cut spending on consultancies. And importantly, what it did was establish this in-house public sector consultancy to ensure that when government departments cut spending on consultancies, there wasn't like a short-term or an immediate capacity deficit. And instead, you know, instead the departments could be, you know, beginning to rebuild capacity in-house. So we know that the data on it is, you know, the data that I have is, you know, just kind of anecdotal, or just from conversations that I've had with people who work in this public sector consultancy, because it's still quite new, it's still quite young. But so far, it seems to be working, insofar as it seems to be working to keep knowledge inside the public sector.
Is it just something you decide? Do you just decide as a government, as political parties who want this? For instance, an X percentage of the money that we're now spending on outsourcing, we're going to pay our civil servants better salaries for that? Is it things so concrete and simple? Or,
of course, this depends on the government structure, the institutional setup of a country, which is why in the book we are careful to provide examples of things that seem to be working well without providing prescriptions. Because, for example, if we're calling for one of the things that we call for is increasing or mandating transparency around conflicting interests in the sector, that would look quite different in different countries, because they have different systems already in play.
But that's something that could also help, you think, for instance, to make rules so that consultancy firms are obligated to disclose their conflicts of interest.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, if we live in a democracy and we recognize that actions of government are accountable to citizens or more fundamentally to their elected politicians in a liberal democracy, then what is required is for those politicians or citizens to have access to information about who is advising the government. It doesn't have to be, you know, in kind of crazy amounts of detail, but actually, if a politician learns that a department is working with an organization that actually earns a lot of income from the fossil fuel industry, you know, we have a right to at least question our citizens, and politicians might certainly be skeptical of that decision and move to change it.
Yeah, because there's a lot of secrecy, right, surrounding the contracts, even like what are the exact circumstances, who pays who and for what, and also what are the agreements in terms of risk and liability. And
no, absolutely. I think in some countries, so as I mentioned previously, in the Netherlands, which is quite unique, there is a rule that mandates private companies to disclose financial information in a similar way to publicly traded companies. That doesn't exist in most countries. So in the Netherlands, we do actually have more information about consulting firms than we do in many other countries, which is great. But still, we don't know, you know, much about who the clients are. And we also discuss in the book how many of these companies actually have a bigger so research has been done trying to estimate where these companies operate around the world using LinkedIn data on their employees, right? So it's kind of rough estimates. And one of the things that this research found was that quote unquote tax havens or secrecy jurisdictions are one of the kind of places where these companies employ a lot of people, certainly more per population size than kind of anywhere else in the world. I think the Cayman Islands has more consultants per population than anywhere else in the world, or more employees rather from the big four.
Because they're so active in helping their clients with tax havens, tax evasion.
Well, the conclusion that this report comes to is that we have to assume that these tax advisory consultants and auditors, that there are so many of them because they are at the heart of tax minimization strategies. That's the conclusion they come to. You know, it's not something we can definitively say because, of course, these are very difficult to study, but because we don't have any
information. Theoretically, there could
them.
Be some other reason for having loads of consultants in the Cayman Islands.
Yes, you know, exactly. But so, yeah, I'll leave it up to listeners to come to their own conclusions,
yes,
perhaps.
I'm sure they'll manage.
Yeah.
Again, more about how to reverse this or repair this. I guess one important thing, not just in terms of money, but it would have to be, the government would have to be an attractive employer for talent, for people with relevant experience, for people with know-how. It's interesting because one of my former guests, Bert Hubert, his name is, he already touched on some of the issues that we're discussing now as well. And we spoke about ads that the government placed when they were looking for people and what they asked of people to come work with the government. And most of it is about, I'm not sure if this translates to English correctly completely, but like political sensitivity, governance sensitivity, like those types of terms. And then in response to this interview, we had another medium here in the Netherlands, De Groene Amsterdammer, did data research on those ads and actually saw that in the last 10, 15 years, less and less expertise was asked of people, like content-wise, like actual experience. And more the standard was, are you politically sensitive? Do you understand this, you know, organization surroundings? That seems like the opposite that you need if you want to sort of gain more control again and become owner of all these topics more.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to come back to the first thing that you touched on, you know, as this is, as we discuss, a systemic problem, this is not just an issue with the consulting industry. This is also an issue with governments and how we think about governments. So I think part of the solution is also, you know, how do we make, if we think about how do we make working for government attractive? And in some countries, it still is. In Denmark, actually, lots of my peers who I graduated in political science with, many of them actually wanted to go and work for the government. It's still seen as a very attractive place to work. That's quite different to the UK, right? So part of that, you know, comes with changing our narratives. A big part of that in the UK, for example, is improving the pay and conditions of people in public service careers, because there has been, you know, a pay freeze in the UK in the public sector for a long time, for 12 years now. So it, and in places like London, that is not just a pay freeze kind of in real terms, that also means that it's very difficult to rent places. It makes rent more expensive, effectively. It makes saving up for a mortgage more expensive. So that is, I think, a big part of how, you know, thinking about how we make government a more attractive place to work also means that we have good conditions for people who work in the public sector. Of course, it also means, and perhaps there are lessons to be learned from the consulting sector here, you know, how do we create the kinds of jobs that means that people feel valued, that they feel that they are able to have an impact, that they are able to continue learning and developing, and that they are recognized for being at the forefront of the green transition, even if what they're doing day to day is super necessary, critical work, but it might be, you know, viewed as mundane or whatever. How do we kind of create a sense that this is valuable, purposeful work again? And that's something that comes from, you know, both our narratives, but also, yeah, how we recruit for public sector careers.
Yeah, you've used the word narrative now a few times, and I've been thinking about that also. A dilemma is that government at the moment is so dysfunctional. Like that's one of the dilemmas I have writing about it also, and also talking about it in the podcast here. On the one hand, it's very hard to ignore all the problems and everything that's going wrong at the moment. And on the other hand, you would want to talk more about, I mean, yeah, it doesn't make sense to ignore that or to paint that prettier than it is, I think. On the other hand, you'd want to talk more about how it should be, like how it could be perceived, because in a way analyzing all these problems also contributes to the whole atmosphere of like, okay, everything's terrible there, you don't want to be there.
No, I mean, if you know, we're not the book by no means, and I think Mariana's work more widely and my research by no means is intending to paint a kind of falsely rosy picture of government, right? We know that things aren't working in the public sector and in many parts of government, but unlike in the private sector, the public sector is accountable to us as citizens. It's accountable to our needs and demands. It's our avenue, it is our vehicle for, you know, governing the economy. And we can use that vehicle, we can use the vehicle of government to transform the economy. So why don't we?
Yeah, but it still seems hard to describe it as something. You have to be pretty idealist maybe to go and work there now. And I think a lot of people who work there are. Like, I get a lot of responses to this podcast from people who work in the public sector. Just often it seems like they're doing that more despite of the system than thanks to the system.
Actually, I was speaking with someone recently who is a public servant in Australia, and she's also doing research. She's also doing a PhD, a doctorate. They have this great program where they encourage people who have done public service careers to then go and do research in the civil service. So I think that's great. Anyway, well, we were talking about how in this kind of twisted way that we should have more faith in the public sector and the potential of the public sector than ever, because in order to be a civil servant at the moment in places like Australia and the UK, you have to be committed. You have to be in it because you think it is kind of publicly valued, because you're trying to, you know, create some kind of public purpose or public value through the civil. Well, you don't have to, but we know that many people are in it for that reason. They're not in it for the money. They're not in it for the glory or the reputation, because those things don't exist. No. So perhaps that's a way of thinking about it as a starting point, recognizing that the people who are working in government, there might not be enough capacity, there might not be enough capabilities because they have been under-resourced or whatever, but at least the ambition is there, the direction is there. It's kind of how do we build and grow that?
Yeah. Would you ever go back? I mean, you started out there.
I worked for an outsourcing organization. I worked for the British Heart Foundation, which is a huge medical research funder that does cardiovascular disease policy for the.
Okay. Well, so not back, but would you always see yourself in academia, or would you consider, after having done all this research and having thought so much about the proper way to do it, would you ever go into public service yourself?
I definitely did. And I've never really intended to go into academia. You know, that wasn't ever really my plan. I've long been very interested in the public sector. My plan was to move to Denmark, where my husband is. When I moved from London, when I've been working in public policy, my plan was to move to Denmark to finish my master's, because in Denmark, you need to have a master's before you can work. And I did my master's in political science and political economy because my plan was to go and work for the Danish government. I did all of my classes in Danish very early on. So I got up to the required professional level of Danish to work in the public sector. And that was the plan. But then, you know, things happen and as they do, and the pandemic hit, and I became very interested in the different private sector actors that were, increasingly involved in the response to the pandemic. And I met Mariana, and I realized, you know, you also learn when you work in public policy, whether it is with a kind of partner of a government, you know, or consultancy or within government itself, you don't have time often to think about these big questions that academia, gives you the space to think about, you know, what is the role of these things? And I've kind of realized, so I would like to work in government, but I also really enjoy thinking about these big questions, like what is the role, what actually is the role of government? What is it here for?
And what about the friends who started out at the consulting companies? Are they still there? Have you ever heard from them?
Oh yeah, don't worry. We're still friends. We're still good friends. We have some good conversations, good debates, good arguments. Generally, you know, my experience has been that my friends who have read the book, who work in consulting, completely agree with the arguments that we make. They recognize that there's problems with the sector. They obviously enjoy their work often. They enjoy the challenges that they are having to do, but they don't think that they're creating kind of value as often as, you know, they're told to say they are.
Yeah, because there's quite a few cynical bits in there as well, right? About just recycling presentations for clients and that type of thing. And as you explained before, just being in there to rubber stamp the decision that's already been made. There's also quite a lot of cynicism, I think, where, if it goes wrong, it's because the client didn't listen to our fantastic advice. Also seems to be part of the culture.
Absolutely. I mean, just to be clear, the people who we interviewed for the book, they weren't my friends. just to be very clear about that.
Yeah. There's anonymous consultants in the book. You're not telling us who they are, but they are definitely not your friends.
No. Oh, well, I mean, if people ever want kind of, we have processes for kind of disclosing who they are. So I can promise you that they were not my friends who were just saying what I told them to say.
It didn't occur to me, but good that you're clarifying. Did you and Mariana hear back other things from the industry, like maybe from management of those big companies?
Yeah, so we have been, so not the big, the big three and the big four have been notably silent. We have heard very little from, or we have heard nothing from them. And we know, for example, when I was interviewed for a BBC Radio 4 documentary on the role of consultancies in our economies, you know, they also asked to speak to the big three and the big four to respond to some of the things that I and the other academics of the interviewed had said. And they essentially they got no comment responses from the consultancies. We also know that because the BBC has a right of reply rule, if Mariano and I were interviewed about the book on a panel, it would be quite important that there was a consultancy there to respond, or a consultant from one of the big three or the big four to respond to us. And we were told by the BBC that they were unable to get anyone willing to come and speak, you know, with us.
What do you make of that?
Well, we know that there's been a strategy of silence, but the Management Consultancy Association, which is the kind of industry body representing consultancies in the UK, the head of that organization has written some responses to the Financial Times and the Guardian about, you know, the book, and everyone's welcome to read those responses. They're quite fun. They're quite interesting.
Why are they funny?
Because that's just exactly what you would expect. You know, when we put this book out, we were looking for some. We wanted to have proper debate. We wanted to have proper challenge. You know, what we don't want, or I guess it's what we expected, but what is kind of too obvious is for the sector to just come back and say, we do create value, you know, this book is wrong, you know, that's too easy, you know, come on. So yeah, but your listeners can check out those letters for themselves. Yeah, but I mean, other consultancies have been very responsive. So I know, I won't mention names, so I don't know if it's public, but there is one big engineering consultancy that has apparently purchased many copies of the book for consultants internally and is trying to use it as a kind of mea culpa. So a way of, you know, rethinking how they do their work. And, you know, probably that's a great thing. Perhaps it, you know, we never know. Perhaps it could just be a way of, you know, I don't know, kind of seeming like they're doing something, but perhaps that's not the case. We know with many smaller consultancies, boutique consultancies, many individuals have been in contact with us and said, we don't want to become like the big three and the big four. What can we do to ensure that we don't create some of these problems that you describe in the book?
Right.
So there has been a good response.
Yeah. Well, anyway, probably politics, government, the public have to make the first step for change. I mean, yeah, I find the book very compelling, but I'm very curious to see whether, because it's almost, I don't know, it's almost like an addiction that you describe, right? Or an abusive relationship. And those are very hard to get out of. So I'm very curious to see if the trend's going to be broken.
Hopefully, you know, as I said, we recognize, and I've been asked a lot, you know, how do we transform this? And what, you know, we've been asked, what were you trying to do with the book? What do you think the book can do? And I'm not so idealistic to believe that books and writing and shining a light on things is enough to change the world by itself, right? We have to be pretty clear-headed about this, I think, as academics and journalists. But nonetheless, it is an important first step. It is important for raising public awareness and creating a public debate. Also, because we wrote this book with civil servants in mind, we recognize that because we knew that many of these problems that we identify are things that people working in the public sector and business themselves, they already know this stuff. Right, they know it because they've experienced it day to day, but they're often unable to challenge it, or they don't have a kind of framework for challenging it. So part of what the book kind of wanted to do was also provide a point of reference for people who, when they are trying to,
something they can point to. Yeah,
exactly. When they are trying to challenge decisions that are being made internally to outsource something to a consultancy when it could be done internally, then they have a book to point to and a framework to use when they're describing some of the issues that perhaps they've already identified but don't necessarily have the words to challenge.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being on, Rosie.
Thank you very much. It's been a great interview.
Dankjewel voor het luisteren naar Stuurloos, een podcast van de Volkskrant. De gast was Rosie Cullington. En als je de moeite waard vond, dan waardeer ik het enorm als je deze podcast bij anderen onder de aandacht brengt. Stuurloos maakte ik met Rinky Bartels, die onder andere al mijn kriebelhoesjes moest verwijderen, met Eva van Leeuwen, die zorgde dat we Rosie er vanuit Denemarken goed op hadden staan, en natuurlijk met Corien van Duin, onder wie er vleugels bij allen opereren. Tot gauw.
Zijn leven is overhoop gegooid. Plus dat heel veel mensen hem niet geloven. Vrienden niet, die denken, ja, hij is gewoon gek geworden.
Hoe naar moet dat zijn? Als je vertelt over de meest indringende ervaringen uit jouw leven en niemand gelooft dat je het echt hebt meegemaakt.
Ja, ik vind zelf niet dat ik het verzonnen heb, maar sommige mensen denken dat wel.
Maar hoe kom je erachter of jij je doelwit bent van een geheime dienst?
Ik heb ook wel eens meegemaakt dat je het idee hebt dat inlichtingendiensten in je geïnteresseerd zijn. En dan kun je wel heel veel zien, wat er misschien helemaal niet is.
Als ik 's avonds nog iets ging eten, dan volgden die mensen mee naar het restaurant. En dan terug van het restaurant naar het hotel.
Als zij op een gegeven moment zei, ken maar uit, want anders word je dadelijk nog ontvoerd ook.
Shit, ik moet hier weg. Dat is niet goed. Nu word ik gevolgd.
Een soort Truman Show is het gewoon, hè. Alsof dat hele straatbeeld voor jou is ingericht. Maar dan wel met bedoeling jou niet door te laten.
Dit kan geen toeval zijn. Een nieuwe podcast van de Volkskrant. Mijn naam is Simone Eleveld. En samen met Huib Modderkolk ontrafel ik een bizarre operatie van de geheime dienst.
Wat het doel ook is, jij verliest het.
Ik werd opgepakt, heel lang ondervraagd.
Maar hoe krijg je grip in een wereld die zo ondoorzichtig is? Als je zou liegen, dan zou je niet de meest relevante informatie 2 jaar later tussen neus en lippen doorvertellen.
Er zal nooit iemand zeggen, oké, Bart, ik geloof je. Nooit, nooit.
Dit kan geen toeval zijn. Vanaf 3 oktober bij de Volkskrant.
Ik weet niet of ik je ook alles kan vertellen. Het is echt te bizar.
Wat?
Ja.
Ben jij klaar voor het allerleukste 30-plus single-event van deze zomer? Samen met Indebuurt.nl en Theater Junushof in Wageningen organiseer ik, Casper van Koten, het Swipe Festival 2024. Met comedy, muziek, wetenschap en coaching. Swipe Festival. Maar vooral heel veel leuke mensen. Bestel nu je kaart op swipefestival.nl. Swipe, swipe.